Winning the money race, is it enough for Dick Lugar? Charlie White says Evan Bayh broke the law. Allegations of voter fraud in the 2008 Obama campaign, Rick Perry in Indianapolis, and Phil Hinkle ties to gay pornography. That, plus Occupy Indy and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending October 14, 2011.
Ice Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. The path to a successful business has unexpected twists and turns. The legal professionals at Ice Miller are dedicated to guiding businesses along the journey. Experience takes businesses to the top. Ice Miller can help them stay there. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.
This week, third quarter fundraising numbers in the GOP Senate primary are in. And they tell an interesting story. Incumbent Dick Lugar raised over $840,000, his third highest quarter ever. He has $3.8 million in the bank. For Lugar, money is not an issue. Challenger Richard Murdoch, meantime, made a personal loan to his campaign of $100,000. That's a sign of money trouble. But how big a factor will outside money be in the Senate race? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel, Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwanes, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Wish TV Statehouse reporter Jim Shella. Mike McDaniel, can Dick Lugar win the money race and lose the election?
It's probably not likely. I think that there's an old axiom in politics that fundraising is always a good barometer, or usually always a good barometer, of a candidate's worth and ability to win. And that's true more times than not. And when you have this kind of a huge advantage, it will make a big difference. Now, with the advent of outside money, potential money coming in, sure, it can be different now than it used to be, but still, they would have to pour a lot of money into this race. And I'm not sure that the current status of the Murdoch campaign with only $301,000 in the bank is the kind of thing that's going to generate a lot of that outside support before this is over.
But there's help coming. FreedomWorks is set to endorse Murdoch.
Yeah, this is supposed to be their number one, the number one Tea Party Senate race in the country. So there's going to be a lot of outside
money. It's the only one
money.
Left where the, in the primary where the Tea Party is
playing, right. As it were. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it can make a big difference. There's no question that Senator Lugar has a tremendous advantage monetarily at the moment. But it is also true that we're not talking about a general election here. We're talking about a primary election. And we're talking about a Republican primary voting population that is much more to the right than Richard Lugar is, and certainly much more comfortable with a Richard Murdoch. And they all know Lugar. I mean, it's not like Lugar's an unknown. So he's going to have a very substantial problem with his own party, because he's been a moderate on a number of issues, and they don't want moderation. They want take no prisoners, you know, our way or the highway, and that gives Murdoch an advantage.
Does it surprise you that Murdoch is spending his own money?
A little bit, because you know, you don't get the sense that they're playing possum per se. I do believe that the money is going to come in from the outside and that it will have an impact. So the money that Lugar's raising now is very good for him. It also has to be spent well. So those two things are still going forward. But I think it's also interesting, too, Lugar has over time appealed a lot to Democrats in Indiana, but with Joe Donnelly declared and in the race, the chances of the Democrats or moderates deciding to take a Republican ballot next spring is very low, too. So it's going to be, I agree with Mike. I think it's not likely, but I don't think that the money race is as clear a barometer as it might be in some other times.
The problem is outside money doesn't vote in a primary.
Right.
Voters vote in a primary. And the significant number for me for this number that Lugar posted, of that $840,000, over $660,000 were from individuals. He has over 6,700 individual contributors. That's an impressive number going into a primary, as Ann pointed out. It is a primary, but that's a lot of people that say, we're for him and we're willing to give him money.
Okay, so Richard Murdoch tried to change the subject. He immediately came out and said that Lugar is on an advisory board for the Roosevelt Institute, which he called a left-leaning organization that has ties to FDR. And Lugar immediately quit. That's motivation for these outside groups that are going to help Murdoch, right?
Oh, I suppose. And I guess you could argue it was a skillful way to divert attention away from the fact that he had lent himself his own campaign money, which, as we talked about last week, can be a sign of difficulty. And if you look at these kinds of races across the country, is often an indication of trouble. So, but Mike's right. I mean, dollars, political dollars, don't vote, but they do help candidates get their message out. And Dick Lugar doesn't need necessarily to get his name ID out. Murdoch does. He's the one who would need to boost his profile to try to get on a level playing field there. And that's where, Jim, you made an interesting point about this being the only show in town for the Tea Party now. Orrin Hatch was out in Utah, was thought to be somewhat vulnerable. Olympia Snow was thought to be somewhat vulnerable. They don't have serious opponents. So this is the opportunity for Freedom Works, which, as Ann pointed out, is an endorsement that's coming, I think, the 21st of October,
right. Maybe
could
Club
open
for
up
growth.
Some additional dollars. But still, you know, I still think everything else being equal at this point, you've got to say that Lugar still has the power of incumbency, which I know some would say that works against him.
But you also have to say that Dick Lugar is vulnerable, don't you?
Well, sure.
There is absolutely no question he's vulnerable. Among Republican primary voters, his appeal are to moderates, and that does not include the universe that are Republican primary voters. There's no question that he is vulnerable. The only question from the beginning of this is whether or not Murdoch gets to enough money to have a critical mass, because this isn't about Murdoch. This vote doesn't have anything to do with Murdoch. It's an anti-Lugar vote on the Republicans.
It's a referendum on Lugar.
I think it is, and he's going to need every dollar he can raise between now and then to spend to counter the charges that are coming.
I still think Mitch Daniels' endorsement of Senator Lugar is more powerful here than anybody's given him credit for.
I'm guessing we'll hear it repeated.
Well, that's the thing. That to John's point, you have to trumpet that endorsement.
It
gets the one-day news cycle, but it's got to be out there.
Believe me, that doesn't mean it's over being used.
The endorsements are good when the people don't know the candidates. If they have an opinion on Senator Lugar already, the endorsement's not going to change that.
Moving on. Indiana Secretary of State Charlie White is now calling for an investigation into Evan Bayh and his wife, Susan. White says the Bayhs are guilty of voter fraud in May's primary election. White is also challenging the Bayh's Indiana homestead tax exemption because they both live primarily in Washington, D.C. The embattled Secretary of State says he wants an independent prosecutor to investigate. And Delaney, what are the chances of that?
Slim to none, and Slim's already left town. I mean, it's absurd on the face of it. The Bayh decision on residency back in the 80s shows intent is what matters here. He has a driver's license in Indiana. He pays Indiana income tax. He owns property in Indiana. He claims one homestead exemption in Indiana, and he has already said when the boys graduate from high school, he intends to come back. So it's ridiculous. But what's interesting about this is he has an attorney.
He intends to come back.
What he has said, he has an attorney. Carl Brizzi is representing him on this.
Charlie White.
And Charlie White does. And either he's lost control of Charlie White, or he's sanctioning this. And I think that's particularly interesting because this goes perilously close to abusive process. And an attorney is not supposed to do that.
He's trying to bring up an example to say that mine is a political prosecution, and if you're going to prosecute everybody, here's a case where you should. But in that case, I mean, Mitch Daniels lived and worked in Washington, D.C. before he ran for governor, right? Nobody questioned that. I'm not sure there's any reason to question that. His attempt to divert attention here is really off the point, isn't it?
Well, I'll say this for the guy. He is a fighter. You can decide whether or not you think the tactics make sense or not. And I will agree that I think that I'm amazed if his attorney is actually recommending that this is a good idea. He may be freelancing. If he is, that'll drive the attorney crazy. But I would agree with Ann that the Bayh decision did lower the standard on residency. It's intent. It's wherever you want it to be. And they ought to be using that to their advantage, not against them.
Yeah. What would cause the prosecution to drop its case against Charlie White?
Mm, something other than this.
Thank you.
This is sort of an odd move because if in fact you're trying to send a shot across, a political shot across the bow, you don't really trumpet the fact that it's a political shot across the bow. And in fact, I think very publicly that's what he has stated.
Sure.
So it's kind of odd that you would engage in blatantly partisan politics and then brag about it. That's kind of odd in and of itself. But as far as your question about what would derail the prosecution at this point, again, it's something other than what I've seen thus far. Yeah.
Again, in the struggle for me to find some logic here, he is the state's chief election officer, although he has tried to say that he's not the state's chief election officer. But he didn't do this as the state's chief election officer. He did it as an individual. I mean, if there was a problem here, shouldn't he do it in his official capacity?
Wow, Jim, that was tortured. that was an interesting and admirable effort to make sense out of a situation that makes absolutely no sense to me. He's trying to be a martyr. Martyrdom is not pretty, and in this case, I think it's ill-guided, misguided, and there is no finding sense in it, Jim. I just don't think there is.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question is, should Evan Bayh be prosecuted for voter fraud? Your choices are A, yes, B, no, or C, let's see what happens to Charlie White first. Last week's question was, who will win the mayor's race? 63% said Greg Ballard, 34% said Melina Kennedy, 3% said it's too close to call. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Former Governor Joe Kernan says a signature on a petition to place Barack Obama's name on Indiana's 2008 primary ballot isn't his, putting it among dozens of dubious signatures found in an investigation by the South Bend Tribune. Kernan, a Democrat who campaigned for Hillary Clinton during the 2008 primary, told the Tribune that he didn't sign the Obama document. The Tribune has talked with more than 40 people who say they didn't sign ballot petitions submitted in St. Joseph County for Obama or Clinton, despite their names appearing on the documents. State Republican Party Chairman Eric Holcomb has called for a federal investigation into the matter. John Ketzenberger, how serious are these issues?
I think they're serious questions, and they've been raised in a serious and responsible manner. So I think that they should take a look at this and try to get to the bottom of it. If somebody's been making up signatures on ballot petitions, then that person ought to be identified and prosecuted because it's clearly against the law.
In its most recent story, the South Bend Tribune has suggested that if not for the fraud that took place, Obama wouldn't have qualified for the ballot in Indiana. Is that a fair assumption?
Well, I guess this conclusion you say is based on talking to at least 40 people who say those weren't their signature. I guess you can extrapolate further, and I guess the suggestion has been that entire pages were copied by hand from a former candidate for governor.
Jim Schellinger,
not to be confused with Jim Schella.
Thank you.
So you can extrapolate, and I guess, and get to a point where you'd say that the sufficient numbers would not be there. But John's right. This is a serious problem because the sanctity of the electoral process, if you don't have faith in it, then everything starts to unravel. And this is probably as much of a non-issue as what we just talked about in the preceding topic. This is just the opposite. This is a serious issue, and it should be addressed.
Serious issue, but what the folks involved with the Obama campaign say that if everybody was doing their job, if the process was working properly, these signatures would have been identified and they would have had time to go out and find other signatures.
Well, there, as the South Bend Tribune story reports, there are other problems with that answer. They presented 534 signatures.
They need 500.
Right? They need 500. 17 pages of them look to be completely fraudulent, which is over 100 signatures, which would take him well below the 500 signature threshold. They were certified in the county election office up in St. Joe County. The Republican name on there, you're supposed to have somebody from both parties stamp these, they used a stamp for the Republican because the lady was out following her husband's death. So they did it while she was gone and used her stamp to put those on there. So that's a question as to whether or not this was part of the way that they got this done and got these through the system. So the answer to your question originally about whether or not there's some validity to the fact that he wouldn't be on the ballot, well, if they only turned in 534 and they take 100 off of that, he wouldn't be eligible to be on the primary ballot in Indiana.
On its face, this is a news story, but it gives validity to all the charges about Acorn committing voter fraud back in 2008, does it not?
Well, I don't know that it gives validity to that. It gives validity to the to an inquiry as to what went on in South Bend, and I think Dan Parker, the state Democratic chair, has called for an investigation as well, because John, I know this is hard to believe, but John was actually right about the fact that you have to have faith in the way the system works. You have to have faith in the way the system works, and if somebody's playing fast and loose with it, that person doesn't need to be in the clerk or the voter registration office. Having said all of that, though, the consequences for that individual, remember, Barack Obama lost Indiana.
No, he won Indiana.
He lost the primary.
He lost the primary.
Against Hillary Clinton.
Right, but
so
if he's not on the ballot.
If he wasn't on the ballot, it wouldn't have mattered from that point of view, because he got no votes.
But it would have changed if he wasn't on the ballot and didn't participate in 48 visits and all the commercials.
Yeah. Well, it likely would have meant that he lost in the fall. It might have meant he lost the nomination.
Likely
would have lost the nomination.
There's a lot of supposition in that. So
let your imagination run wild.
He didn't lose the nomination because of his loss in Indiana. His loss in Indiana didn't contribute to his getting the nomination. But what I'm saying is, these things
momentum
need to be
created
raised.
Here. There was momentum created here.
Maybe, but there's supposed to be a system of checks and balances on this, and they need to be observed, and they're observed for a reason, so that people have confidence in the integrity of the process. And if something's wrong up there, it needs to be fixed.
But let's be practical here and realistic. This is not going to invalidate.
His
presidency. It's not as if somebody's going to say we got to redo
the
election.
Help,
but what it does
might help energize a Republican.
Well,
base
and it might also lead to some criminal charges for people who worked on his behalf in Indiana. And that's I think a much more likely
for future
outcome.
Consideration.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure.
All right. To this year's race for president, or actually next year's, Rick Perry's campaign for president got a boost here in Indianapolis this week. The Texas governor held a series of events at the Columbia Club. Perry held a private fundraiser and met privately with some Indiana Republican leaders before he spent about a half hour on stage. There, he delivered a stock campaign speech that included a reference to job creation.
Their families. And one of the fastest ways for that to happen is for a president of the United States who will open up our domestic exploration and our domestic lands where all of these resources can be produced. And we can do it in an environmentally friendly and safe way.
John Schwanis, this was the fourth visit in response to an invitation to all Republican candidates by Eric Holcomb, the state Republican chairman. Will there be more?
Well, he put out, close to a dozen?
He invited everybody.
I think
11,
some people.
There are still 9 in the race.
Some people sort of poked fun at the whole idea with these people come trekking to
maybe some people in this studio.
But I'll tell you what, we've said this before, and it's the truth. Eric Holcomb deserves a lot of credit for extending these invitations, for putting Indiana, making it a must-stop destination for these candidates early on. And it's good for the process to see Republican voters in Indiana who typically haven't had an opportunity to interact with the A team. They're usually getting surrogates, future first cousin or something. this time they actually can see these people and size them up firsthand, and that's a good thing.
For Perry, was there anything at stake with this visit?
Oh, I don't think there's anything at stake. I think it was good politicking. He was able to raise some money, was able to be among a friendly crowd, and here's got to be the sales pitch to these folks from Eric Holcomb, whom, I have to say, I was one of the only people here who said good for Eric, and I did say that, Mike. Go back and look at the tape.
You weren't the only one.
Okay, you did.
Thank
too.
You.
I think it was everybody but Jim.
but the pitch has got to be, look, we lost Indiana the last time.
Right.
And we can't afford to lose it again, and it's going to be one of you who is going to make it happen, and we want to help you. Please come. Let's work together.
And in the meantime, some of the Obama campaign have said that they expect to win every state they won last time except Indiana.
It's not
a good contrast for the Democrats,
is it? We'll see. I mean, it's ironic, and Eric does deserve credit for bringing them in and hopefully energizing people. But the irony of this is when you put Rick Perry in the A-team, you have a governor, another governor from Texas, who has no foreign policy. His energy policy is drill, drill, drill. He wants to dismantle Social Security, and he views Medicare as socialism. You look at this and you say, his whole campaign is cratering. The only candidate out there with any possible appeal to a more general audience is Mitt Romney, and he has no appeal to the Republican primary voters. And you look at this and say, there's no leadership there at all.
You worried about your field?
No. I think any of these people will beat Barack Obama next time around. He is tanking. He has tanked and will continue to tank between now and the election.
You met with Rick Perry?
I met with him this week.
Your impression?
He was in town. I was impressed. He's got a good record in Texas on jobs and a lot of other things. He presented himself very well. I was surprised. I don't have a dog in this fight, and I went because I'm still kicking tires. Yeah. And I enjoyed his conversation. Eric Holcomb has done a great job of getting people back. Herman Cain is coming back next week
for a second visit for the beefsteak dinner.
And Eric is reintroducing and reinviting all those who haven't come. To say, look, see what publicity they're getting. So I look for all of them to be here before it's over.
Moving on. Now, new developments in a state house sex scandal.
Phil Hinkle voted to ban gay marriage, was caught propositioning a male prostitute. Yeah, when asked to explain himself, Hinkle said, well, I wasn't going to marry him.
First there were jokes, now there's more trouble for State Representative Phil Hinkle. Cameron Gibson, the teenager whom Hinkle hired on Craigslist, has posed for two pornographic websites and in a statement says he did it for Representative Hinkle. Quote, I can show him what he and his pals really missed out on, he says. Hinkle, who says there was no sex when he took Gibson to a hotel room in August, reacted over the phone saying, the kid's a liar and a thief, and outside of that, I don't want to comment. He did say he still has no plans to resign. Mike McDaniel, can this get worse?
Yes, and will get worse. Every time any kind of a story like this comes up and it's brought up again, you're just torturing his family, and that is worse. When the session rolls around and the people of his district cannot be represented properly because he can't be effective in this role, that's worse. I mean, this thing will keep getting worse and worse and worse until he finally decides to do everybody a favor and step aside.
There's no way you can defend a decision to stay at this point, is there?
It's hard to... There's no way you can defend any of this, okay? I mean, you can say what you want about what did or didn't go on in that hotel room, but you'd have to be a Pollyanna to think that the purpose of that meeting wasn't what he's saying didn't happen. And you look at this and you just say, in this day and age, you go on the internet and you recruit somebody you've never met to come meet you in a hotel room. What kind of judgment is that? But Mike's right. The pain that his family must feel every time they turn the TV on and see this is probably incredible.
Should we be doing stories like this?
That's news. And you like it or not, it's part of it. And in this case, I agree completely with Mike. It's time for Representative Hinkle to do the one thing that will stop these stories, and that is to get himself out of the public eye.
Is there anything that anybody else can do to make that happen?
I don't think so. I mean, you've seen already Republican leadership in the House, Brian Bosma, House Speaker, call for very publicly and privately for his departure, for his resignation. They've removed him from his committee chairmanships. This is obviously a very high profile and public embarrassment. I don't see anything else that would, legally there's nothing that can dislodge him from that position at this point. It's short of some kind of recall, which I don't even know if there's a recall provision in Indiana statute. So no, the answer to your question, I don't see anybody or anything drumming him out if he doesn't want to go.
Finally, the Occupy Wall Street movement came to Indiana this week. More than 500 people came downtown last weekend saying they were angry over the actions of elected officials and corporate leaders. Occupy Indy continued on Sunday and Monday, but by the end, crowds were small. And Delaney, is that the opposite of the Tea Party?
I don't know that I'd say it was the opposite. I mean, the Tea Party and the Occupy Wall Street movement are both angry. I mean, they're angry. And they're angry at the bailout. They're angry at lots of things. The bailout was done in 2008. And it had bipartisan support because no matter how badly you liked it, you thought it was the only thing to do. The difference that strikes me between these two groups is that looks like a young group to me, whereas the Tea Party looks old.
I think that's true.
But the other
does it make sense to be protesting on a weekend and not on Columbus Day when the State House is closed?
No, it really doesn't.
I think there were four reporters and a state trooper in the State House.
The biggest difference.
You covered it.
A little bit.
The biggest difference is that the Tea Party parlayed this into actual political action. It's too early to tell whether this will be translated into real political action.
Yeah. Was this a good rally?
I'll go to what Ann just said. If the desire of a rally is to get some free media, some attention on a slow news day, which Monday, because it was a holiday, would have been, sure. And we're talking about it now. I guess that accomplishes something. Again, I don't think they have a clear message of what it is.
Say, no message, no leadership, no agenda other than that.
Yeah, but sounds like the Tea Party from there.
Well, have to remember that when the Tea Party began, it was just a bunch of angry people. This is still very early. It's happening across the country. We'll see where it goes.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/podcast, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity. Just go to Hoosier TV and look for Indiana Week in Review under News. I'm Jim Shella of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Ice Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Things can go wrong in a thousand different ways. Businesses need a law firm that knows the thousand and first. The team of legal professionals at Ice Miller is committed to helping put the pieces back together. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.